kind of antenna did you just mention, and which kind of satellites would you like to monitor, Bill? KC2SYL, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, this is the KC2SYL. It's a helical antenna. I'm referring to the antenna handbook. The picture in it, and it indicates, the text indicates you can use it to monitor the amateur satellites. Just want to get some information on the construction of it, a homebrew type, and the pros and cons of using it either horizontally or vertically or aimed at the satellites. Back to that.
Very fine, Bill. Now I heard the missing word, and that was helical antenna. A helical antenna, properly constructed, gives you a lot of bang for the dollar. To a person looking at one for the first time, it just looks like a long piece of wire curved into a spring-like arrangement, suspended with a bunch of insulated rods in order to encompass some number of turns, and that in turn gives you a an antenna with reasonably broad bandwidth, reasonably good circular polarization. The inventor of a helical antenna was Mr. John Krause, and he did that way back in the 1950 time frame, just before he came out with his book called Antennas by John Krause, which is now in its third edition. He's now a silent key. W-H-J-K was his call letters, and he's the man who was essentially the head of the RF Electrical Engineering Department of Ohio University, a guy who lived in Michigan a lot of his life, and I think he may have been the founder of the Electro Science Laboratory at Ohio University. Let me drop. Now, when you talk to the ham radio operators who have built helical antennas, and particularly when you talk to WA5DJB, Kent Britton, he's the man who runs the antenna testing laboratory, so to speak, at each one of the Central States VHF Society and the microwave update conferences. The ham radio operators will set up a antenna range in the parking lot at each one of these conferences that happen each year, and they go and measure antennas. And when you talk to Ken Britton, you'll find out that helical antennas properly built do a great job. However, it is an antenna that's got some peculiar, characteristics that you got to be careful about. If you start off with a known good design and you use all of the materials that the original guy used and support that helical wire the way he did, it should give you the exact same results that he got. However, when you make changes in the materials that do the support, you would think that the insulating rod going down the center of the helical antenna that holds it all together, that you can substitute material A versus material B and use different diameters and whatever. You make those changes, and you think you've got an antenna that with a photograph looks the same, but all of a sudden it behaves very differently. What Kent has found on a number of occasions is that, he will take somebody's helical antenna, he'll set it up on the antenna range, and the antenna range he sets up is almost always a linear antenna range. So if your antenna range is set up for horizontal polarization, and you've got a helical antenna that's set up for, let's say, clockwise circular polarization, when you listen with the helical antenna to a linear polarized signal, in theory, as long as the signal is pure, it's coming into the antenna being tested, if you rotate the antenna about its long axis, in other words, you rotate it like a screw, there should be no change in the signal strength. If there was a change in the signal strength where the peak and the valley were, let's say, 2 decibels apart, you could say the antenna has a 2 decibel axial ratio. An ideal helical antenna would have something closer to 0 dB of axial ratio. In the case of a radio antenna where you're measuring its standing wave ratio, the usual rule of thumb is 2:1 as to where you are. Better than 2:1, you're getting academic. Above 2:1, you should start applying some corrective action. In the case of a helical antenna, if your axial ratio is 2 or 3 decibels, that's okay. Everybody thinks that you've got to make the standing wave ratio 1.1:1, and the axial ratio has got to be 0.01 dB. That's much too exacting. 2 of 3 decibels of actual ratio is quite good. If you take a linear polarized signal and you listen to it with a circular polarized good helical antenna, you lose 3 decibels of potential signal. Conversely, if your signal that you're listening to is circular polarized and you listen to it with a linear antenna, again, you lose 3 dB. A circular polarized signal, you could think, Bill, it consists of half of its power is horizontal, half of its power is vertical, and those two powers are 90 degrees displaced. Depending on which one is displaced, horizontal and vertical, which one is 90...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Depending on which one is 90 degrees ahead or behind, means that the signal in your... This clockwise signal is either the signal that you're transmitting, the circular polarized signal, is either clockwise or counterclockwise. When it comes to listening to a circular polarized signal from a satellite, be sure you know which circular polarization it has. If you set up your helical antenna for clockwise and the satellite is giving you a downlink of counterclockwise, you'll lose an awful lot of signal. You want to make that match. So there's a little bit of care required to make sure you use the exact same materials as the original design, and even if you use substitute materials, with a little bit of smart, you can set up a fairly simple antenna range at these VHF, UHF frequencies. You can set up an antenna range in your backyard, or in a schoolyard, or in a parking lot, and you can make the measurement of the actual ratio of your antenna. You can literally twist it like a screw and see if it favors one position versus another position of that rotation, and you can measure its actual ratio. Measuring a standing wave ratio is not too difficult. Sweeping it in frequency to find out how wideband it is, and is there a frequency where it works better? That's another thing you can do with your antenna range when you set it up. But the raw materials that go into a helical antenna, in general, are not very expensive. So even if it takes you building Model 2 and Model 3 because the first one you built didn't work out so well, that's not a bad thing to go through. It's a good learning experience because the materials are not expensive. Build a couple of them. If you take a look at John Krause's article on the Big Ear, it's a book that he published, soft-covered book, not very expensive. Let me drop. That was his first great big radio telescope in Miamisburg, Ohio, I think it was, at the Wesleyan University, I think it was called. It consisted of 96 helical antennas. That was his first serious radio telescope. And he made a whole lot of good radio astronomy measurements of various extraterrestrial sources with that 96 helix array. And as I said, he's the inventor of the antenna, and therefore him to go out and build a great big antenna with 96 of them that were tiltable on the ground as one great big array was it's a fun article to read, and he made some really great measurements with it. It's a very nice antenna. It's a little bit exotic. It's a beautiful looking thing when you build it correctly. And so have at it, Bill, and let us know how it goes. KC2SYL, which satellite would you like to listen to, Bill? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just one of the amateur radio satellites. I have to do a little research to get the exact one. But once again, I'm looking at the plans, and it looks pretty basic. Even if you could just take a, say, one-inch diameter PVC pipe and wrap some number 18 wire around it, it looks like, and put the proper connector, obviously, to the receiver, it looks like it would work. The other question I would have is, how would it work in terms of reception from the horizontal to the vertical and to 180 degrees to the other horizontal? Back to that.
There's a fairly strong similarity in the theory of operation, Bill, of a helical antenna and a Yagi antenna. If I built a well-designed 10-turn helical antenna, and I measure its azimuth and elevation beamwidth, and if I built a 10-element Yagi antenna, and I measured its horizontal and vertical beamwidth, there would be a strong similarity. The patterns would look fairly similar. And by the way, you can make a circular polarized antenna by taking a single boom and setting up Yagi-like elements, horizontal elements with a driven element horizontal, vertical elements with a driven element vertical, all on the same boom. That also makes a beautiful circular polarized antenna. The beauty of doing it with Yagi elements and having a horizontal feed line and a vertical polarized feed line, is now by switching between those feed lines, you can transmit, electronically switch between horizontal, vertical, clockwise, and counterclockwise by switching the way you use those two transmission lines. In the case of a helical antenna, if you make the helix a right-hand helix, let me drop, that antenna from then on is, in theory, a clockwise, circular, polarized antenna, right-hand circular polarization, because of the way you set up the helix. I have seen one or two articles of where people have experimented where they make two helixes around the same center support structure, a horizontal, a clockwise helix and a counterclockwise helix, displace them a little bit so that they don't touch at the crisscross point. So you can make two circular polarized helical antennas on the same support structure. Do worry about, though, if you take the helical wire and simply wrap it on a piece of PVC pipe, mechanically you've done a good thing. The PVC pipe is an insulator. You would be tempted to ignore the insulator. If you're not taking somebody's well-established design, where if he didn't use PVC pipe of your brand name and of your thickness, and if you're making a change of the design, the very subtle thing that can happen is the presence of the PVC pipe, which is a dielectric material, creates a slow wave structure. It creates local capacitive loading of every one of those turns in the helix. So you can end up with a design that doesn't work anywhere near as well as you would like it because you've made a material substitution. So as Kent has discovered very painfully, as many of the guys who sign into his antenna testing laboratory at each one of these events, and he's been doing this now for 15 years, he also does it over there in Europe at some of their gathering get-togethers, he's discovered that people who make drastic substitutions on a helical antenna quite often end up very disappointed. Let me drop. By comparison, because in the case of a Yagi antenna, if your particular Yagi antenna design told you to use 1-inch square wooden material to make the boom, and you use 2-inch square wooden material, because the wooden material is at the center of each one of the directors and reflectors of the Yagi antenna, it has, as long as that particular insulating material is non-conductive near the center of the elements where the voltage is very low, it would have almost no change in the performance. By the same token, you take the support material that you use on a helical antenna, where now the support material is essentially in direct contact with the high E field of the helix. It has a drastic effect on its performance. So I'm giving you some warning ahead of time. Be careful about what materials you use, what changes you're making on the support materials and support technique on a helical antenna. It is a little persnickety in that one effect. Now, the helical antenna is a beautiful looking thing, but when it comes to complete adaptability for horizontal, vertical, clockwise, and counterclockwise, two crossed polarized Yagis constructed on the same boom has a little more to offer, in my opinion. Let me drop. But now your original question, your last question was, if you're listening to a horizontal polarized signal with a helical antenna, it'll work like a charm, except the gain will be 3 decibels lower than it would have been for the same number of elements of Yagi, because the helical antenna is always looking for a circular polarized signal. It's always looking for a signal where half the power is horizontal and half the power is vertically polarized, so to speak. And you're only listening to one of those, and you get a 3 dB loss. That's not a showstopper, but it's a slight disadvantage. However, the other way around is if the satellite you want to listen to is circular polarized, and you listen with a linear antenna, again, you're going to suffer a 3 decibel loss. If the signal you're listening to from the satellite is clockwise circular, and you're using a clockwise circular antenna, whether it be Yagi or Helix, then you get full performance. You don't get the 3 dB of loss. The only place where you get a huge amount of loss is if the signal was horizontal and you listened to vertical, you're going to get a huge loss. Or if the signal was clockwise and you listened counterclockwise, you're going to get a huge loss. Other than that, you only get a 3 dB loss with those other two combinations. Maybe that was the information you were looking for, Bill. KC2SYL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, a lot of information. Once again, I'm referring to the antenna handbook, the AWRL antenna handbook. And there's a section in there on helical antennas. And I do indicate in one of the materials listing to use tomato steaks. So I would think those items are pretty well available. Once again, and I understand the difference now with the PVC pipe about the dielectric constant. One other, just to try to amplify the question, if you rotate the helical antenna, and say you construct one that's right hand and one left hand polarized, and you rotate them from horizontal to vertical to the other side horizontal, what would the effect be specifically on listening or monitoring back to net?
If the signal you were listening to was a pure horizontally polarized signal, and if the helical antenna was perfect, nobody builds a perfect one, but if it was perfect, and you rotate the antenna around its axis as if it was a wood screw. If you turn the helical antenna as if it was a wood screw, as you turn it through 0 to 360 degrees of rotation, the signal strength you pick up would not change. Sweep that antenna in left and right in azimuth, the signal will fall off with a normal antenna pattern characteristic. Looks a little bit like a sine X over X pattern. There'll be a main lobe, it goes to a null, there'll be a first side lobe, that'll be all 13 or 15 dB down, a second side lobe, that'll be 17 dB down, and so on. Normal antenna pattern. When you sweep it in azimuth, or you sweep it in elevation. But in circular polarization, you sweep it, the signal strength should stay the same. If the signal was a circular polarized signal, and you rotate it like a screw, and if you had a very carefully calibrated network analyzer, the signal would not change in amplitude, but the signal would slowly change in phase by 360 degrees at the carrier frequency. If you're using it, say, for instance, for listening at 435 megacycles, and you rotate it like a screw from 12 o'clock through 3 o'clock through 6 o'clock through 9 o'clock and back to 12 o'clock, you've made a full turn of the helix. And if you had the right kind of instrumentation, let me drop.
Stand by a second, Dick.
You want me to give you dead carrier?
Just hang on a second.
RC2 repeater controller V5.282. Clock not set. Clock not set. Ready.
One more second, Dave. Sorry.
Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Clock not set.
KE2EJ disconnected.
Go ahead.
Okay, for those who are curious, what just took place, Eric Glass?
Say, Index.
For the benefit of those who might be curious, what just took place?
One of the computers was all upset, which was making the controller all upset, which was making the whole system upset, even though you didn't notice it.
So I think you're saying that either the EchoLink people or the IRL people were not getting a clear connection throughout that process before you made that correction. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I've been making everything operate remotely, but this is the last thing that I haven't been able to take care of yet. But that'll probably get done before the next week is out.
Very fine. Okay, to finish that last statement I was making, Bill, if you had the right kind of instrumentation, and say, for instance, I'm using the helical antenna at 435 megacycles, and I rotate it like a screw through 360 degrees, believe it or not, the phase of the RF signal, if I was using a vector voltmeter or a network analyzer where I'm measuring amplitude and RF phase simultaneously, I will literally see the phase shift by 360 degrees as I rotate the antenna like a screw through 360 degrees. And if you read some of the past articles by John Krause, he was able to rotate individual helical antennas of his great big bed spring of these things, of 96 antennas, in order to electronically steer the beam in space. By mechanically rotating the individual helical antennas, he was steering the beam. By the same token, the University of Illinois, the Vermilion River Radio Telescope, used a very similar technique. It was a great big parabolic trough antenna built into a hillside in Illinois, and that particular radio telescope would steer its beam electronically by mechanically rotating the individual helic antennas that were the feed horn assembly for that great big parabolic trough antenna. So put that in your hip pocket as one more interesting capability that a helical antenna has. Maybe some of this information helps. When it comes to circular polarized antennas, you're in a fairly exotic area, Bill. Anything you learn will be way ahead of even the antenna engineers. You'll be amazed the number of antenna engineers who think anything to do with circular polarization is black magic, and they have trouble understanding it. Step by step with the right instruction.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Step by step with the right instruction, it's not that bad. It's a good thing to learn. You'll now know something that very few other amateurs are comfortable with, or very few antenna engineers are comfortable with. KC2SYL, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thanks, Vic. Appreciate that. I know you want to get back to the mailbag. It's a couple of minutes past 9:30. For those of the listeners who are interested worldwide, Boston 6, New York Yankees 2, bottom of the fourth inning. Back to that, and thanks for the info. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay, with the chicken. Bill, come back in future weeks and let us know how that project is going. Let me pick up Joe, because we quite often bypass him by mistake. I'm going to pick up Joe. If he's got a long question, we'll go through part of it now and part of it later. And if he's got a quick one, we're going to answer it right now. W2RYY. Go right ahead, Joe. What's the latest in your neighborhood? We haven't heard from you for a little while. K2RYW in the TechNet. Eric, I just did a check. I think Joe is trying to come in through the 375 Eastern machine. And right now it appears as though the Eastern machine is not connected to the net. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Let me see. I mean, that's possible. Let's see. Come on a second.
KE2EJ, check.
Go ahead, keep talking. I'll give you a report in a minute.
Roger, Dodger. I'm doing a check right now, and right now I'm not coming through the 375 machine, so it appears as though the 375 is not operational or not connected at this time. Yeah, still not connected, so therefore we're not able to pick up Joe. So let's go over to the mailbag while you're fixing that one, and I guess you would like to cover how to use an oscilloscope, how to use a vacuum tube voltmeter, and how to use soldering, how to do soldering. I think you're saying, Mel, that these are some of the questions that you frequently get asked. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. All right. The frequently asked is, first of all, setting up a little laboratory. You know, a miner's laboratory, and what's going on. And we had mentioned, we left off last week, we mentioned about, you know, getting a nice little desk or will be perfect with a somewhat of a decent light. And, of course, even with good eyes, young people with good eyes today, still a nice magnifying glass. If you have one on a little stand, they have these ones on a little stand. They help because a lot of these surface-mounted little devices are quite small, so there is times that a magnifying glass comes into hand. Now, we got up to the point of soldering. Most important, I guess, thing that you will ever do in electronics is to solder something together and soldering properly. You do not have to buy an expensive iron. Go to Radio Shack. They have some nice little pencil irons. They got solder. They got little things of flux. And there's also another product you'll see there. It's called solder.
Note number 9126.
Let me let it drop.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thanks, Bernie.
Now, I suggested that you look around, find yourself maybe from an old TV set, take out the printed circuit board, take out a printed circuit board from a stereo or a DVD player or a videotape machine, and practice. See if you can take the part off the board by using solder with that will suck up the solder. They give you instructions on how to use it in a little package. And what you'll do is see if you can unsolder like a transistor or a resistor or a capacitor or a diode. And then you can look the device over, maybe do some testing on it, and see if you can learn how by practicing on a board and see if you can solder it back. So basically, this will begin the experiment, and the information will come along with the experiment. You know, as they say, sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. Maybe easier to do it yourself. Read the book. Yes, read books. But sometimes we'll experiment. So up to now, this is basically what you need. Now, let Dick critique this before we talk about anything else in the way of electronics.
Yeah, Christian.
VL, repeater.
Very good material, Mel. A heck of a lot of the circuits you're going to build if you're a tinkerer. I mean, there's many ways of doing ham radio. Although people use derogatory words to explain it, a so-called appliance operator, in my opinion, can be a very good ham radio operator. An appliance operator is a guy who buys his radios in completely operational form and hooks up an antenna, maybe hooks up a feed line to an antenna on the roof, and gets on and starts discussing things with people and finding out other information by that manner. A slightly more crafty guy will eventually start building his own antenna, building his own radio, transmitter, receiver, whatever. Electronic circuit, tone generator, vacuum tube, voltmeter. There's lots and lots of things you can build. Once you start any kind of building, the best way of connecting circuits together, whether you're wiring wires together and you want to make good contact, or you're putting down components on a printed circuit board, 90-some-odd% of the time, all of those connections are made by high-temperature soldering. High-temperature meaning it'll burn your finger 400-and-some-odd degrees Fahrenheit, but it's not high temperature as far as things glowing in the dark is concerned. And Radio Shack will sell you... Let me drop.
Hey, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Try 3-7-5 for me, will you?
Roger, stand by. Hello, radio, K2LAW, I'm 375. When I hear my own voice, turn back to me, delayed, it ain't easy to keep on talking. Looks like it's working.
Thank you.
Okay, looks like we got the Eastern Link back in operation, and therefore we'll have the ability to pick up with Joe in a minute. It'll be a few minutes. But holding circuits together for making good electrical contact. If you're twisting wires together, you want to solder those junctions. If you're putting Perkins components on a printed circuit board, you want to solder it as a method of holding the circuit down. You're melting this low-temperature material, usually in the old days made out of lead and tin. That's the ordinary 60-40 type solder, and it does an excellent job. However, properly preparing the junction, making sure everything is clean, the copper on the printed circuit board, you might have to rub it with steel wool. Although you really shouldn't use steel wool on a printed circuit board. You should use Scotch-Brite, because you don't want to leave little metal whiskers around that can give you phony contacts. Scotch-Brite or fine emery sandpaper or whatever. But you want the printed circuit board to have clean copper or clean tinned material, and you might want to put down something called soldering flux to help the process, and you might want to buy at least one, if not two, Unger satellites, soldering irons. Unger happens to be a popular brand name of a not very expensive pencil-type soldering iron. And literally practice. It's an art form of making junctions and cleaning junctions. And what Mel was talking about is solder wick is a material that's in a little rolled container, a plastic container, and it looks like copper braid. Oh, it's about an eighth of an inch wide copper braid. You hold that against something that is soldered, and you apply your soldering iron on top of it. The heat spreads from the soldering iron through the copper braid onto the solder joint, and the solder will literally, by capillary action, wick itself into that solder braid, and the solder will leave that junction. And it gives you the ability to step by step remove enough of the solder. Let me drop. So that you have the ability to remove that component from the board. But there's a catch. No matter how much you use solder wick, a very, very tiny, thin film of solder will still remain, and to some degree, that component is still connected to the board. If you do a very good job of solder wicking, the amount of film of solder that's left is so small that with a pair of needle-nose pliers carefully used, you may be able to break that component away from the board without damaging the component. You may be able to do that. An alternate approach worth considering. First of all, you can really buy a soldering station which has a dual-tip soldering iron, and you apply solder. You apply a soldering iron to each end of the surface-mounted component simultaneously. That's one approach. It's the expensive approach. There's a slightly cheaper way of doing it. Let me drop.
$85 in the radio shack.
I'm amazed that it's that inexpensive. $85 for the dual soldering iron. Okay, that's one approach. The other approach is to buy a pair of inexpensive Unger soldering irons, make yourself a foam block of just the right shape that with rubber bands around the two soldering irons holds the handles against the foam block so that the two tips of the soldering irons come together at just the right spacing so that now you can touch the north end and the south end of that resistor that's on the printed circuit board, heat up both ends simultaneously, and now either with those soldering irons or with a pair of tweezers, you can now remove that component from the board without doing all of the solder wicking job. Alternate approaches. Give us a couple of words on that, Wesley. Are you saying that the dual soldering removal system is sold at Radio Shack for $85? I wasn't aware of that. That's not a bad price, although for a real beginner, that's still a little bit pricey. N2XJN for some comments on that. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, they don't sell it very often. This is November to X-ray Juliet November Mobile. And I'm heading towards Long Island right now for a book. Anyhow, I saw that for $85 in Radio Shack, but actually you can buy it for much less in eBay. I have recently purchased a lot of devices in eBay, and also another thing that is very helpful is a breadboard. And I'm hunting for the breadboard, and you can buy a very decent breadboard for $13 on eBay. Back to you, Dick, and to Xia. WH4,
I'll check in next week or two.
Don't give up, Joe. We're going to spend a little bit of time on the mailbag, and then we can go back to your question. What Wesley just mentioned, so by way of eBay and or Radio Shack, you can buy the so-called dual soldering iron for removing a component from a printed circuit board. That could be very handy. You could make your own homebrew version with a block of foam with just the right shape and rubber bands holding a pair of soldering irons. I've seen people do that very effectively. Wesley also mentioned so-called breadboarding material, vector board. In Radio Shack, in the bubble packs, you will find little pieces of printed circuit board which have a whole bunch of holes in them, and some of them have copper stripes with holes, by which you could lay components, put the leads of your resistors, for instance, through those holes and make a circuit out of them. So
eventually you're going to want to build a circuit, and vector board is a way of doing it. But the main thing that Mel is mentioning right now is that to learn how to solder and to learn how to desolder, it is an art form. At first, the first few solder joints you make are going to be cold joints. They're not going to be very strong. They're not going to make very good electrical contact. There's a learning curve you have to go through. And maybe Mel can even mention a website we can go to where somebody presents a video, something like YouTube, which shows you with a close-up lens how to do it. And that would help a lot. And when it comes to having good visualization, I've got a whole lot of opinions on that, but I'll hold them for a further discussion. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Comment.
This is K2KEY. All right, let's leave it at that. That's enough for the digest this week, and then next week we'll go on to the next thing that we had talked about, the basic instrument. But let them just get used to flying, like I say. What you're going to do is you're going to get that soldering iron at Radio Shack. I believe they also have another device there that they sell fairly cheap. It's a solder sucker. It's a little pump. Little thing that's a spring-loaded little pump, I believe, that they're still marketing to suck the solder from the connection. With that, you've got to be very careful if you can overheat the device or the water or whatever it is, you know, easily damaged, whereas Rick works fairly well and also very cheap. So first, get yourself an old PC board from a TV set or whatever. Like I mentioned, look around the street, look in the basement. I'm sure, so ask relatives. Somebody's got some old VCRs around. They got old TVs around. Take the circuit board out. Nothing's going to happen if you handle the board. It doesn't like this. It won't explode. It won't burn you or anything like that. Take some of the components. Look them over. Understand what they're like, what they look like, transistors and diodes and things like that. Let's
I have a comment.
Yeah, Wesley recognized Erica. You might want to know the 375 machine is disconnected again.
K2YO.
It looks like it has been reconnected. Go ahead with your comment, Wesley.
There is another interesting approach, especially for the microprocessors and the chips. You can have a dual station. One is with regular a soldering iron, and the other one is a hot air one. Now the dish, the end of it, is actually at the size of the particular chip. So when you're heating it up, you can actually pull it out without any damage to the circuitry. Back to you, Dick.
Another good suggestion. It could be a little bit on the pricey side. So when it comes to removing a component, for instance, a surface mount resistor or a surface mount capacitor or inductor from a printed circuit board, the approaches are solder wick to remove the solder, a dual soldering iron, and there's at least two versions of that, one that's really made with two tips and a separatable, it's sort of a soldering iron tweezer-like thing, or you can make a homebrew version out of a pair of, say, Unger needle tip irons and a plastic block, a foam block with rubber band around it. Mel also mentioned a solder sucking device, and there's two at least kinds of those. One is a spring-loaded device where you press it so that it's in the loaded mode. You heat up the junction. This thing has a plastic tip with a hole in the center. You hold it near the solder. You press the trigger. The spring expands. It sucks the solder into this solder sucking device and removes it from the junction. There's also a version of that sold by Radio Shack where the iron has a unusual looking tip where the iron has a hollow section to it, and connected to it is a red bulb. And as you squeeze the red bulb to expand the air out of it, hold it near the junction that you want to remove the solder, heat up the junction, then relax the little red bulb with your other hand, and it sucks the solder inside of the iron.
Yeah, but there is the one that is actually heating with the hot air and then sucking. Back to you.
Like, hold it.
Yeah, that's a slightly more expensive approach. Go ahead, Mel.
Oh, we're getting away from the subject. I said I want to keep this as for a beginner. It's not getting the hot air for it. An expensive thing. This is not for that. For a little budget, person just beginning. So let him now. Let's leave it at that. A regular soldering iron, some wick, some of the fluff that's hanging up there in the Radio Shack. You can buy all this. I mean, a $10 bill. It's very cheap stuff. I looked at it. And this is where you're going to begin with the board, and that's it. Then we'll take it next step. We're bombarding them with too many variables at this point. Forget about surface mounted even now for even that's going to be a little exotic right now. Certain surface mounted, even though this, of course, is the way electronics will go. But let's just leave it with the older board where the component sits on the top and the solder is down a single, you know, regular fitted circuit board, single layer, and let them just do that. And I'll hear how they're making out if they got any questions about getting that far. Okay, that's it for tonight. And next week we'll take the next step. Because we're jumping ahead with too many exotic things. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, you got a good point, Mel. We've all had various experiences, and we want to tell people about it, but we got to keep it simple. Mel, when it comes to solder, my recommendation, and maybe you have another opinion on this, is if at all possible, try to use the old-fashioned solder, 60-40 lead-tin solder, or eutectic solder, 63-37. But 60-40 is a very popular kind of leaded solder with ordinary solder flux material. It's a brown liquid that helps the solder joint solder better. It makes the solder joint easier. The so-called lead-free solders, that in itself is another additional art form. It's much more difficult to use, in my opinion, and I think we are overreacting as a society where we're trying to eliminate lead from solder. There is an awful lot of disadvantages from doing that, and I think the lead on printed circuit boards, in my opinion, has not been the major factor contaminating our environment. So the old-fashioned solder, which with some difficulty is still obtainable, works so much better, gives stronger, cleaner joints, and forms those joints a lot easier. I'm recommending it as the beginner. You might have an opinion on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, they have it hanging up there, little rolls of it, little packages, say in a little plastic packages. I looked at it, 60-40, regular old 60-40 solder, 032 diameter, and that, I think, and a little green bottle of that, a tube of flux, and they explain to you, basically, they do give instructions, basically, on how to use each one of these things. So we'll leave it at that. Let the people experiment, the young people solder, unsolder things and all, and get an idea of what the components look like, the handle, and next week we'll, after they take them out, we'll talk about how they can use a simple little meter. Say you can buy a little meter, a little digital meter, a little analog meter, which they also have in the bubble pack, and amazing what you'll be able to do just with that instrument for beginners. I wish I had the availability when I first started as a youngster of one of those meters. That was in my tree. So let's leave it at that, Dick. We'll go on with it next week. Go ahead and continue with the TechNet. This is K2KEY.
I was just in Radio Shack buying the battery for my remote control for the alarm system for my Toyota automobile, and I looked at the bubble packs on the wall, and they've got some very nice analog volt ohm milliammeters in the bubble packs for numbers like 8 and 10 and $12, and the $15 one has got a nice big meter on it, and I think there's even a $15 version for a digital multimeter that can measure voltage and ohms. When it comes to the most basic measuring equipment, either a volt ohm milliammeter or a digital multimeter, is very hard to do without that. With one of those, you can measure how many volts are coming out of each one of the penlight batteries that you plugged into your particular appliance. Let me drop.
and knowing whether or not that particular pen light battery is brand new and putting out 1.56 volts, or it is almost at the end of life and it's putting out 1.30 volts. That's a very important thing to know. If your particular piece of electronics is starting to misbehave, the first thing you want to know about is it a battery problem? A hell of a lot of the things we use these days are handheld battery-operated devices, and no battery lasts forever. A brand new 9-volt transistor battery will measure something like 9.7 volts when it's never been used, and at the end of life it may measure something like 8 volts or 7.5 volts. By the same token, a 1.5 volt pen light cell is something like 1.56 volts when it's brand new. At end of life, it's down to 1.3. And even if your particular handheld device has got four pen light batteries in series, you can put your probes of your multimeter, whether it be a volt ohm milliammeter or digital voltmeter, you can connect them. The negative lead to one of those batteries and take the positive lead and walk down the string one step at a time. And when you go through one cell, you'll measure something like 1.5. When you measure through two cells, you'll measure something like 3.0 volts, four cells, 4.5, and so on. You can walk down the string while they're plugged in to your appliance just by taking the back of the battery cover off. And so with a multimeter, a lot of very good measurements are made. So Mel is recommending that the first thing you do is solder. I'm sort of recommending the first thing you do is to have a multimeter where you can measure volts and ohms, AC volts, DC volts, and ohms, because without making measurements, without making measurements, it's kind of hard to find out what's going on. With those measurements, you've got a lot of information as to what's happening and why it's happening. If you put your ohm meter across a resistor and the color code tells you it should be 1,000 ohms and you measure 10,000 ohms, you know something is wrong. Or, again, if you measure it should be 1,000 ohms and you measure 57 ohms, again, you know something is wrong. So a lot can be done with a meter. I think a meter is the very first thing to have. You think soldering is the very first thing to have. Let the guy make the choice as to which way he wants to go. Ultimately, I think he's going to be doing both. I wonder if you've got some opinions on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No doubt. Well, some of the questions about purchasing meters and all is going to leave that for next week because it's after 10, so I'm sure we're losing the audience. And we could discuss brands and meters from even older meters that some of the fathers may have, uncles, or whatever may have laying around, you know. So not to rule them out, you'll have to find a good old meter like a Ico or Simpson. That's what I'm going to go through next week after they get out some resistors and diodes and other little parts off the board. How we're going to use these meters to check them, even be able to check the meter itself. So that's the next step, Dick. But like I say, the audience is gone by now, so let's go on with the TechNet. Go ahead.
One comment on soldering. Okay, soldering comment. I'm going to pick you up in a second. Let's pick that comment up first, then I'll tell you something about meters. Soldering, please give me your call letters and name, sir, and then go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, fine business. This is WA2 Victor David Henry. His name is John. Only comment I wanted to make about soldering, maybe I've watched Christmas Story too much, but I find that a pair of goggles is probably a good thing to have. I've unsoldered a couple of things sometimes, and I flicked them and found that a piece of solder right at the corner of my glasses, and I was sure glad I had my glasses on at that time. Back to you, Dick.
Comment from Wesley.
Wesley recognized, but I'm going to comment on John's comment first. An extremely good point of view. Whenever you look to any of the science programs that are on world or science or nature or whatever. Any of the television programs where you see high school students, grade school students doing a science experiment, they're almost always wearing plastic goggles. When you're doing the work with what you think is super safe stuff, you really want to protect your eyes, particularly if you're cutting things with a pair of side cutters, a very simple operation of cutting off the length of a resistor with a pair of so-called dikes or side cutting diagonal cutters. You wouldn't believe it, but that little piece of wire at the end, at the instant the break is made, that little piece of wire can fly off at a ridiculously high velocity, and that can embed itself in your eye. And I've heard of a few stories of where that's happening. When you're doing soldering and desoldering, although it's low in probability, occasionally an air pocket forms and a puff of hot solder comes bursting out, and a splash of that can happen on your eye, like John is talking about. It happened on his glasses. Let me drop for a second. And while you're at it, you can buy glasses that have 2-to-1 magnification to them, so-called close-up lenses. That gives you a double advantage. Number one, you've got a medium amount of eye protection when you're wearing these. Second of all, now you can focus your eyes up real close to the circuit and you get a magnified image. And I've used those and they're very successful. And they're in some drugstores and whatever, emporiums, you can buy these 2-to-1 magnification. I think it's called a 2-diopter positive lens. In other words, it's a convex lens type of glasses which give you a magnified image, but you do want to protect your eyes. You'd be amazed how valuable that particular organ is, and you'd like to keep the smoke of the soldering out of your eyes. You'd like to make sure that the splashes of solder and high velocity things that you're cutting don't come flying into your eye. Definitely consider that. Wesley, go ahead with your comment. N2XJN Mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is N2XJN for the TechNet Mobile. Yes, 23 years ago, even 4 years ago, the good school for soldering would use not a paste, but use the californium. The californium is a thick liquid that is produced by the trees, and actually is extracted from the trees. And look, amber color, it has amber color. Now, the same material is being used for the violin, just to make this violin sweep, I don't know how the string on the violin, right? Resonate probably by increasing the friction. I do not know, Dickie, if you recall that product. Now, this one is healthy, it's natural, and has amazing smell. When you heat it up, back to you.
Now, that's a new one on
Y-O.
That's a new one on me, that the californium, which I think you say you rub it onto the horsehair of the bow of a violin to increase the friction in order to make better sound out of the strings of the violin, and that's a good soldering flux, if I understand correctly. I've used the ordinary so-called rosin flux quite successfully. So what we're talking about here is that most modern-day solders, they really contain a 32nd of an inch or a 16th inch diameter rod of solder that's on a roll, and when you look at it under a microscope, you'll find out that the solder that you're using, the round rod of solder, really is hollow, and there is a rosin core inside of the solder, which helps the soldering process. And what we're discussing here is that in some cases, by putting the right kind of a flux material, just a brownish or yellowish material, onto the two items that you want to solder together, by putting that material onto those surfaces ahead of time, it helps the wicking process. When the materials are sufficiently hot, and you're supposed to heat the material first and then touch the solder to the hot material, at first a neophyte person will tend to touch the solder to the soldering iron. The good news is it melts the solder faster when you do that. But if it's not making contact with the materials that you want to do soldering of, if those materials are not preheated, the solder may not wick correctly. Let me drop.
But this liquid that you're talking about that is inside is actually sparkling, and that's why you need the goggles. Now, the best and the most amazing effect you have from californium, so maybe some from the old ham radio operators will recall what I'm talking about. Back to you.
On a quick break, Wesley, where does a person obtain californium? Is that something that's sold by Radio Shack, to your knowledge? Back to you, Wesley.
NY2H.
Well, how about if you Google for that? This traditional way of soldering was used by the decades by whole Europe, not only Eastern Europe, whole Europe. It was absolutely amazing. It was not sparkling. It wasn't creating any sparking effect, and was absolutely not requiring the goggles. And you had your tip of your soldering gun absolutely shiny. Back to you.
Now, there is a real very heavy element on the periodic table, which was artificially formed, which is called californium. And I think that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about a kind of rosin that I think is rubbed onto the horsehair of the bow of a violin to make friction so that the tone comes out more pure when you rub that bow across the violin string. Do you happen to know the spelling of the material, and have you seen it sold in the United States? Where and how expensive, if you happen to know, Wesley? N2XJN Mobile, K2RIW.
The stick cost around 50 cents or $1. I saw it in Radio Shack, but I didn't see it recently. I have a kit that I bought from Radio Shack that came from, actually, I believe, China. And this kit has a little round cylindrical container that has the californium in it. And this works. This really works. I was doing a very delicate job in my FT-817. And after so many years of soldering, and I mentioned that I did have in Eastern Europe my own manufacturer when I was manufacturing the amplifying devices for the programs of TV, because the antennas were with very poor reception. Let me drop. Okay. I see the difference, and the difference is absolutely visible. When you take this, the way that you do it in United States and the way that we did it before, and I believe in United States it was done before. When you take a look, I open up one of these vintage military meters, and I saw, apart from the solder, a remains of the californium. So it was quite a time ago. Back to you.
I think that Radio Shack has from time to time sold something called a soldering kit, which includes a small number of tools, a small soldering iron, some solder, some flux, and I think you're saying this tube of material called californium or something close to that.
It's solid. It's not liquid. It's not a tube that you can squeeze it.
Okay, so it's a solid rod, very similar to the rosin-like rod that you rub onto the bow of a violin bow. Is that what you're saying?
Actually obtained that from the violin manufacturer. I mean, from where the violin guy buys it. Back to you.
Okay, if I go to a good music store that sells violins, most likely they have a kind of rosin that's used for rubbing onto the hair, the horse hair of a bow, and I think you're saying that a dab of that material makes very good soldering flux. Is that what you're saying, Wesley? Go ahead.
It's the best I know of. And I was soldering for